So, one of the lovely things about America is that, and you know, there's just not a lot to love these days. Let's face it, there's just not much to love. But one thing I do love about America is that an American Jew wrote the song White Christmas. Isn't that nice? The same Jew, actually, who wrote the song Easter Parade, which, you know, I bet Jesus would have loved, because, of course, pretty influential media Jew himself. Israel Beilin was born in the Russian Empire in 1888. He emigrated with his family to the U.S. at the tender age of 5, fleeing abject poverty and bloody pogroms, like you do. At Ellis Island, he and his other young siblings were detained in a holding pen, like chattel. His father, an erstwhile synagogue cantor who could only find work as a kosher butcher and part-time Hebrew tutor, dropped dead when Israel was 13. His father's death, of course, left his family toiling in penniless Dickensian squalor, like you do. Izzy left school, he hawked newspapers, and his big dream, his truest, bluest ambition, was to become a singing waiter in one of the rowdy saloons on Manhattan's Lower East Side. And he eventually got his dream. This mangy, Yiddish, white trash, guttersnipe hood rat, he reached for the stars and became a singing waiter whom customers would throw pennies at when they liked the popular tunes he'd picked up on street corners. His newfound proximity to saloon pianos allowed him eventually to crudely pound out a few new ditties of his own. Though he had to teach himself how to play, he never learned how to read music. Though once he began slowly to craft his own songs, gradually figuring out what kinds of simple melodies and lyrical phrases the patrons of public alehouses took a shine to, he would eventually crank out a winner called Alexander's Ragtime Band, which would sell a million copies in sheet music in the year 1911, the year he legally changed his name to the less ethnic-sounding Irving Berlin, and which launched one of the most prolific songwriting careers in American history. And he was a beloved pop songwriter. In addition to his holiday classics, he penned Puttin' on the Ritz and Blue Skies and There's No Business Like Show Business. But it was his patriotic anthems that intrinsically linked him to Americana. Irving Berlin wrote This Is the Army and a hilarious ode to boot camp buglers called Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning. But most important, he wrote God Bless America. And he famously turned over the royalties of God Bless America to the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, netting them millions. He was deeply magnanimous. Berlin famously avoided his accountant's advice of using tax shelters because he claimed he truly loved paying his taxes. So grateful an adopted American son was he. Last Friday night, in front of Mount Rushmore on the eve of 4th of July, President Trump vowed that to replace the increasingly torn down statues felled by American cancel culture, a new garden of statues of American heroes will go up in their stead. Irving Berlin shall be one of them. And it's unclear if President Trump loves Irving Berlin because of his Russian heritage, or the fact that he couldn't read music any better than the president can read a briefing document, or the fact that some of the casts of the movies and reviews that he wrote music for wore shoe polish on their faces. I come to think of it, it might be that. And, you know, Izzy Beilin's statue might not make it very long when you think of it. Anyway, it's hard not to think about 5-year-old Israel just off the boat in an Ellis Island holding pen, waiting to be processed, waiting for the door to be held open to him. All those unwritten American songs swirling around in his head, tingling in his 5-year-old fingertips. Kind of makes you wonder how many great unwritten American anthems are currently trapped inside 5-year-olds' heads, trapped inside cages on our southern border. It doesn't feel great to think about. Anyway, to kick off this week's show is a great Chicago musician who will spend the rest of his career being introduced with the caveat, no relation. Here's Sam Trump.
You wake me up in the morning. That's why I call you sunshine. I put you to bed every time. That's why it's always good night. It's just a puppy love thing, yeah. That's why you feel so right. You're the first thing on my mind.
I see y'all back there.
And my very last thought is you before I close my eyes. So don't you go changing. So don't you go changing. Don't you go changing. I love what you're about and the sun is out. So don't you come raining on my parade today. Just stay this way. Just stay this way. Just stay this way. Just stay this way.
That was Sam Trump, and this is the Machete Audio Magazine, July 20th, 2020. I'm Christopher Pyatt, and speaking of statues coming down, this week a statue of Melania Trump near her hometown in Slovenia was set on fire. Yikes. This brought to memory a visit that Melania Trump famously made to the Green Mill in 2018. As y'all might remember, in the fall of that year, the First Lady was heavily criticized for her travels abroad, in which she was trolled for her wardrobe, which made her look like a dilettante. She claimed that this made her the most bullied person in the world. And the only other thing you need to know about this performance is that when she made her grand machete entrance, she was carrying a huge cross, which she dragged onto the stage. So, with that, here's First Lady Melania Trump.
Hello. Hi. Hello. Very happy to be here with you today. Don't worry, the cross is very lightweight, like me. I'm lightweight from many years spent as a very successful model. In fact, I am the most bullied model since Tyra Banks put on the fat suit and walked around the streets of Manhattan for one day and even more bullied than the fat community who had to listen to Tyra Banks cry about her experience as a person wearing a fat suit for one day. This must be some kind of dream. Some kind of nightmare. I must have jet lag from my trip to Africa. A trip that brought me much success in my Be Best campaign. I visit a school in Malawi where I tell the children, be nice to each other on the Facebook. Because because this is the greatest issue facing the children of Malawi. I go to Egypt. I go to Egypt and I dress as Indiana Jones. And I stand in front of the pyramid and I pose like this for the camera. And then I say to all the cute little sphinx and the cute little mummies, I say, be nice to each other on the Twitter. And even though I work so hard to spread this anti-bullying campaign message, I, me, Melania, am bullied. All people want to do is make fun of what I'm wearing. When I go on safari in Kenya, they say my helmet is a symbol of the colonizer. I say it's a symbol that I'm chic. Stop bullying me. Pay attention to what I do, not to what I wear. Unless you want to take a picture. You know, there is nothing wrong with wanting to take a good picture. I am not so different from all of you. You, with your Mental Health Awareness Day, okay? Posing on your Instagram, it's a picture like this, you know? You're like this, I have depression and anxiety, but each day I learn to accept myself more and more. Okay? That's you, doing it for the gram. Or like a national coming out day, okay? You post a picture like this, and you're like this. You're like, it's like, this is my hottest new fall look. And you're like, oh, I'm so gay, and I accept myself for who I am. But really, you're just doing it for the gram. I'm not tone deaf. I'm giving my best look. When I go to Japan, I dress as geisha. When I go to Iowa, I dress as farmer. When I come here to Chicago, I dress as hot dog. I too am doing it for the gram, okay? But I can't even enjoy the Instagram anymore. Or the Facebook. Or the Twitter. Because day in and day out, I am forced to endure ruthless bullying. I am the most bullied person in the world. You see, it's not like we live in a day and age where I could just hire someone like a social media assistant to run my accounts and delete negative comments and block the haters. It's not like I'm surrounded by security that can ensure my personal safety at all times and prevent even the threat of physical harm. Or that I have access to the finest support for both my mental and physical health after enduring the trauma of having people speculate about my marriage without hard evidence. my life is so difficult. I remember walking through the shelter of children separated from their parents at the border. And I remember thinking, what would I give for such a simple life? For a moment I thought, little boy with no answer to when you'll see your parent again, and or whether you'll be sent back to a country where you might be murdered, or remain in a country that so far has cut off your family and placed you in a cage. Little boy, what would I give to switch places with you? But then I realized, Melania, no. If we switch places, that would make him the most bullied person in the world. And I can't let that happen. I must protect the children. I must protect me. That is why I create Be Best campaign to teach the next generation to stop bullying me. Thank you.
Melania Trump is the paper machete creation of the irrepressible Aaron Diamond. So, speaking of powerful political families, this week Prince Harry and Meghan Markle very courageously urged the British Commonwealth to start acknowledging and grappling with its ugly colonial past, a suggestion plenty of Brits were not crazy about. This, of course, started at the beginning of this year when Harry and Meghan officially renounced their royal titles. Next up is an essay from this past January when they made that announcement. Here's Mackenzie Chin.
Saga of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry lean the fuck away from the fire swamp that is England's monarchy is maybe the most riveting real-time soap opera I've witnessed in my entire life. Now, I don't typically give a fuck about the royals. And I used to find it strange how grown people would obsess over old, stodgy figureheads that have no real power or political purpose, but the renegade dark horse energy of Meghan and Harry just hits different, you know? This week, Meghan and Harry announced that they will relinquish their royal titles. In the same week, a documentary aired on UK's Channel 5 in which Meghan Markle's father, Thomas Markle, asserted that the couple's actions are, quote, turning the royal family into a Walmart with a crown on it. Like the people I once judged, I've become a little obsessed with this entire story. I'm obsessed because Meghan and Harry's decision is not just about them wanting to live a more peaceful life. It's not just about giving the middle finger to a 1,500-year-old institution. It's about two people who happen, like me, to be a part of the much-maligned millennial generation, making a conscious and disruptive choice about who and how they want to be in a world where, depending on who you are, everywhere you look can feel like a trap. A quick recap. On January 8th, Prince Harry and Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, announced that they would be stepping back as senior members of the royal family. This stepping back includes working towards financial independence from the royal family, so paying their own bills, and residing part-time in North America, so getting the fuck out of that dreary-ass Brexit-voting, non-seasoned food, having Great Britain. Okay. People, as you might imagine, lost their shit. They said a lot of mean, nasty, and often incredibly racist things that instead of repeating, I'll just let you imagine because I know you can. And accused Meghan of stealing Harry away from his royal destiny and sovereign duty. Now, In the midst of all this indignation, black women everywhere who are not Meghan Markle were like, sure, Harry's a prince, but could the dick really be so good? Could the dick really be so good that you commit to spending the rest of your natural black life in rainy-ass England, eating bland food surrounded by these half-melted-looking Brits who talk shit about you and voted for Brexit? Is the dick that good? And indeed, one of the biggest motivators of Megxit, as it has been dubbed, Megxit, is the incessant racist criticism to which Meghan has been subjected. Now, some argue that vitriol from the media and general public comes with celebrity territory, but this has been inarguably more caustic than any before, including that which played a part in the death of Harry's own mother, Princess Diana. One of the most notable critics of Megxit, however, has been Thomas Markle, Meghan's father, the one who said that by leaving the monarchy and earning their own income, Meghan and Harry are turning the family into Walmart. Not Target, Walmart, okay? Quote, this is one of the greatest long-living institutions ever, he says, of the monarchy. They are destroying it. They are making it shabby. Thomas, who did not attend the royal wedding, also admitted to selling staged photos to paparazzi, saying, at this point, they owe me. The royals owe me. Harry owes me. Meghan owes me. A little background about Dad of the Year, Thomas Markle. He's currently 75. He's Meghan's white parent. By the way, are white men okay? I don't know if you guys are okay. Anyway, according to Wikipedia, he worked in the film industry as a lighting director on General Hospital, where he met Doria Ragland, Meghan's mom, who he married in 1979. By the way, have y'all seen pictures of this woman? At 63, Doria Ragland is a total box, okay? She was a makeup artist before owning her own business, and after that, she went back to school, got a master's degree, and became a social worker serving patients at a mental health clinic. Right? She was by Meghan's side on her wedding day and flew to Britain to be with her after the birth of Meghan's son, Archie. Unlike Thomas, Doria seems pretty cool, which makes me wonder how someone as giving and capable as her ever got with someone like Thomas Markle, a guy who speaks to tabloids about his daughter, but not to his actual daughter. Like, have you ever met a couple where you're like, cosmically, nothing about this tracks? Like, it doesn't make sense. I mean, I guess we have all had that one or two or 10 relationships where we're just like, yeah, I don't know what I was on. I really tweaked for the entire duration of that 3.5-year shit show relationship. Anyway, Doria and Thomas eventually divorced, duh, but not before they had Meghan. A few months after the wedding, Meghan sent her dad a handwritten, private, deeply emotional letter in which she asked him to change his behavior both in their personal lives and in their public-facing ones. Addressing the letter, Daddy, she tells him, quote, being able to live with a clear conscience is more valuable than any payment in the world. Predictably, the letter leaked, likely by Thomas Markle in exchange for payment, to a conservative British tabloid. I like the Urban Dictionary definition of gaslighting the best. According to it, gaslighting is a form of intimidation or psychological abuse where false information is presented to the victim, making them doubt their own memory, perception, and quite often, their sanity. Gaslighting happens in celebrity, including monarchies, when the masses who claim to adore you also eviscerate you for having baby weight after having had a baby. It happens in families when a parent whose whole job as a parent is to love and protect you instead feeds you bit by bit to the wolves and calls it love. It happens when you're black and have lived your entire life under the white gaze, are still somehow invisible, and so you don't even realize that you've created a whole other self designed to be amenable to that gaze, and now that self at times subsumes who you truly are. It happens to a generation who is told the only path to a good life is through college, and then spends the rest of their lives waiting for that good life to start, if only they could find a job that paid them enough to get out of the college debt they took on in order to have the good life in the first place. We're raised to think we're playing a game we can actually win. But if we're all being gaslit, you, me, Megan, Harry, what do we actually owe to those assigned families and inherited traditions, particularly the ones that imperil our sanity and our very survival? Meghan and Harry stepping back is riveting to me for a lot of reasons, not least of which is a prince choosing a black woman over an entire kingdom. But it's most riveting because it's something so many of us dream about doing, breaking free of the restrictive path that we believe we have no choice but to take. It's riveting because it's actually about revolution. It is a function of fear and a failure of the imagination to not envision a way of being beyond what we currently know and what is no longer serving us. So, when you go to bed tonight, before you fall asleep and get up in the morning and go about everything planned out for your tomorrow, I want just for a minute for you to close your eyes and imagine what's beyond the walls of your own old, drafty palace, one you don't love, but are just used to. Then imagine what's our collective beyond. Really see it and begin to know what it could feel like if we climbed over the wall together. Thanks.
Maryland native Mackenzie Chin is a highly hyphenated artist, filmmaker, poet, actor, activist, living in Chicago. This week, the Trump administration hinted that foreign college students must leave the country this fall if their schools offer online-only classes. There's obviously a lot of confusion and anxiety around this. To address these matters and more, we now bring you an MPSA, an MPSA, MPSA, a machete public service announcement. MPSA. Enjoy.
Greetings, esteemed universities and academic institutions of America. Yeah, you too, DeVry. Why not? You have a certain responsibility to every single student who's deemed that a degree with your name on it is worthy of their time, money, and crippling Adderall addiction. In exchange for at least tens of thousands of dollars of debt that will marginally be paid back over the course of an entire human lifespan, you owe these students an adequate education and the necessary skills to succeed in the workplace. And the ones you owe this to the most are your international students. In 2019, the total number of international students enrolled in U.S. colleges was 1,095,299, making up 5.5% of the total U.S. student body. International students typically pay full tuition, which boosts revenues for schools. They also spend heavily on housing and other goods. International students contributed more than $30 billion to the U.S. economy in 2015. That same year, Stable Genius decreed through Twitter that when foreigners attend our great colleges and want to stay in the U.S., they should not be thrown out of the country. Well, that genius was none other than the current president of the United States, Donald Swamp Dumpster Trump. Just this week, Trump reversed his position and called for immigrants studying in the U.S. to leave if they're not able to attend an in-person class beginning in the fall. Now, it's already more difficult for international students to even be accepted into college. Foreign-based students have to attain extremely high GPAs, surpass English competency exams, procure stellar recommendation letters, meet certain admissions quotas, pay higher tuition, book international flights, secure housing, and after all that, discover that some guy who paid for someone else to take his entrance exam is pulling their visa in the midst of a raging pandemic. If deported, these students face numerous obstacles when they have to return to their home country for online classes. They have to overcome internet speeds along with time zone differences and lack of access to materials. Some schools are scrambling to create a one-credit in-person class only for international students that qualifies for an exemption under the Student and Exchange Visitor Program regulations. Even though it can be difficult to fabricate an in-person course with a meaningful curriculum, it's not impossible. So today, with the paper machete, let's look at some very suitable suggestions as to what these classes these international students can enroll in. First off, we have ESL, which stands for English as a Stupid Language. Help rewrite the entire language that is the most frustrating to learn for foreign students, especially the parts that make absolutely no sense. Park on a driveway, but drive on a parkway? Plural of mouse is mice and goose is geese? Tough, cough, and dough don't even rhyme? Go fuck yourself. Next up is Intro to Citizenship. Navigating the naturalization system can be daunting at first, but this interactive class breaks it down into very simple steps. Final is curved, and every passing grade will be handed out in a lottery system. U.S. History, January 1st, 2020 to present. What in the fuck happened in the past 7 months? This advanced level course should normally be issued to students that have a basic grasp on post-revolutionary America and the Industrial Revolution. But this is for the extremely ambitious that really want to tackle how this great nation went from putting a person on the moon to being completely divided on whether or not the coronavirus is a hoax. Biochem 3, which is just 1 hour a week of showing up and watching a VHS movie or a group trip to the zoo. One of the best blow-off classes you could take. Psychology 101. Introductory to learning about the amazing human mind and its functions. Just kidding. It's an entire class devoted to mass shooter drills. Potions 2. This course is just someone dressed as Snape blocking the door and protecting students from ICE agents. Because nobody else will apparently fucking do it. SAT prep. This class only takes an hour to prepare you for the most lucrative job for a foreign student in the Trump administration. Getting paid to take the SAT for an American citizen. DeVosology. This is a 300-level course geared towards business students. That's in reality an elaborate pyramid scheme, but it's too late before you realize what's going on. American policy in the Middle East. Pass or fail depending on whether or not students can accurately hurl their footwear at a poster of former President George W. Bush. Unlimited tries. Sex ed. Crash course on our growing bodies, and by the end of the semester, you'll be ahead of the general American public on your mastery of understanding a woman's right to choose. Not recommended for those squeamish about rights. Advanced economics. This prestigious curriculum will be taught by a different person each week who will solely be guilting you for stealing the entry-level jobs of hardworking Americans. Computer science. Sure, you could learn to design and analyze algorithms to solve complex programs for the performance of computer hardware and software, but in this updated and more useful program, you will learn the proper technique in using your camera phone to record a racist when they yell at you to go back to where you came from. Prerequisite is advanced economics. Health and exercise. Get drunk with your professor and then hit the outdoors just to take down problematic statues. And finally, Ivy League capstone. Very informal course intended for those graduating and would like to help colleges such as Harvard somehow justify charging full tuition for Zoom classes. If you have trouble getting in touch with your advisor or an immigration attorney, not to panic. Just take this moment to look for the classes that mean the most to you and your sense of urgency to stay in the United States. At the end of the day, this higher education system that risks your life, health, and general well-being might not be worth it. It might just be better to defer for a year while the U.S. just goes to complete shit and then get a degree from a school in the Caribbean like everyone else.
That was Oklahoma-reared, Chicago-based comedian Shuroop Kareem. Shuroop is one of the producers of People of Comedy. So this week it was announced that Pete Buttigieg has a new book coming out this fall. Y'all remember him? I know! Mayor Pete was still burning bright at the beginning of this year when we were still doing live shows, to the joy of passionate moderates and the consternation of pretty much everybody else. Here's a set from that time and a person from the aforementioned everybody else camp. This is Audrey Jonas.
Pete Buttigieg looks like he just found out about Ethiopian food. I've never met anybody who likes him. I've met people who are like, he's fine, which is how I feel about one person in a friend group from high school who's a friend of somebody's from college. And the group started like a thread about going to New Orleans. And I was like, I'm free the first weekend in February. And she was like, so am I. And no one else was free. And now we're going to New Orleans together. Like, I know who likes Trump supporters. I know who they are, right? They were on the gymnastics team at my college. They're married to a sheriff. The most political thing they post is like a crock pot recipe for Mexican food, and like they work at marketing. And I don't know anyone who likes Pete Buttigieg. And when I told Paper Machete that I was gonna do a piece about Pete Buttigieg, they were like, great, no one's ever done an essay about him yet. And he just seems like exactly the type of like neoliberal Ken doll that we love to make fun of here, which like leads me to my next theory, and it's that, are we all on a prank show? Is this a prank? And the prank is that the mayor of the Midwestern version of the Friday Night Lights town is running for president. Does anyone know how many people live in South Bend? 102,000 people. 102,000 people. Think like Irving Park to Devon. The lake to Clark. And that is 18,000 more people than live in South Bend, Indiana. Something about the way he delivers his speeches in this sort of like spoken word cadence, like he already thinks he's being recorded for like the greatest speeches in history, and then he kind of like dips his head down and like gives the people some puppy dog eyes, and then like really leans on those consonants, like, we must have higher standards, right? Whenever I look at him, I'm like, wow, he would be great to play himself on SNL. I have never gone to a job interview and been like, me, I'm an outsider. Like, if the debate stage was a comedy show and the booker was like, we wanted to book an outsider who's never written a joke, I'd be like, I'm not doing this show. I have other things to do. If I told my friends I was applying for a job with a leap as big as mayor of South Bend to president, they would be like, are you okay? Like, we know your New Year's resolution was to put yourself out there more. We thought it was like wearing more prints or something. Like, I just, I teach stand-up comedy. Don't worry, I'm not changing the subject. I'm still on Pete Buttigieg. I teach stand-up comedy to a bunch of very pleased with themselves white guys. And occasionally a couple really sad white guys who like are going through a divorce, and then they say things like, this is my therapy. And I have to be like, you have to know that therapy is cheaper than these classes. They've got all kinds of sliding scales and things. And the people who take comedy, stand-up comedy classes are just like so excited to get their ideas out there. And the thing about that is that their ideas aren't different and they're not gonna actually change anything. To me, the coolest thing about Pete Buttigieg is that he met his husband on Hinge. Because I'm like, who meets people on Hinge? the only people I meet on Hinge work at Ernst & Young. They're like, I know the best places for tacos. And if you're nice, I'll let you in on the secret. And let me let all of you in on the secret. It's never a Mexican neighborhood. And it's always Big Star, okay? That's the secret. If I did meet a Pete Buttigieg on Hinge, I absolutely would go on a date with them because I'm an idiot. And then they would take like so much pleasure in like talking to the food runner in Spanish and then like making the Uber driver take a selfie with them to be like, new friend, hate has no home here. I just think diversity is what makes this country great. I just guess that's just my own quirky thing. I have a problem with his obsession with bringing back decency and civility. I'm over decency and civility. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a Mexican-American woman. Like, I want to paint the White House magenta. I want to menstruate on the White House lawn. I want to rip my enemies to shreds. I don't think he's a stupid guy. And I'm not trying to diminish, like, what he's gone through or his experience. I don't think he's a bad guy. I don't want him to be president. The same way that, like, I don't think my ex-boyfriend is a bad guy. I just don't want to be his girlfriend, you know? I can't help but wonder what makes him different besides being, like, moderate, measured male whiteness, right? And, like, palatable commitment to the status quo. And my issue isn't with him running for president. My issue is the way that people talk about him being, like, the underdog, right? And, like, calling him an unlikely candidate is like calling someone with an Irish last name an unlikely candidate for judge in Chicago. I know how Pete Buttigieg got here. He's smart and handsome, and even my Catholic mom, like, doesn't really care that he's gay. But he just, like, and he just, like, kept talking about running for president over and over again until one day it happened, and I wish everybody could have that. I just don't understand what people find exciting or compelling about him. But what I mostly just don't understand is how people just think he is just this guy who just had an unlikely rise, like how Adam Driver is like Hollywood's unlikely leading man. Like any decent looking white guy with unbridled confidence in himself, that is the definition of a likely leading man. My question for all of us this afternoon isn't how did he get here? I know how he got here. My question for us is how did we get here? Thank you.
Audrey Jonas is a stand-up comedian born and raised and quarantined in Chicago. And finally, while Mayor Pete might be trying to transition from Midwestern mayor to post-Oprah book club sensation, he's nothing compared to that phenomenal American who can't stop reinventing himself, Kanye West. Of course, this week was the week that Kanye finally took off the MAGA hat and renounced the president and declared his own presidential bid. Hashtag sigh. That said, here's Skylar Higley.
The first time, or one of the first times, I appeared on the Paper Machete live show, when we can do those, was actually to talk about Kanye West visiting the White House and visiting Donald Trump. And my take at the time was that the version of Kanye that currently exists is, first of all, white people's fault. And secondly, obviously a huge disappointment. And I come to you now begrudgingly reporting on Kanye again 2 years later, back in the news, because in a Forbes interview this week, he has apparently denounced Trump and advised that he previously tested positive for COVID-19, and of course, infamously, that he is running for president. And as much as I want to start making fun of him and taking jabs at the numerous absurd, insane things that he said, like the fact that vaccines are the mark of Satan, or that Joe Biden just isn't special, or that we should ultimately trust in God to solve coronavirus. Those close to Kanye have apparently advised that he's currently experiencing a bipolar episode, and this is all in a manic state that he's said all of this. So, I don't know. It's obviously good that Kanye denounced Trump, but to be honest, I'd prefer if we just didn't talk about the things Kanye did or said ever again. I kind of wish he, not as a person, but as the thing he is in our society, just kind of didn't exist. Let's explore the two dimensions of why everything going on with Kanye is fucked up. On one hand, it's pretty well known that Kanye's been a volatile figure due to his mental illness, and although his personality trait is that of a troublemaker ever since the often quoted George Bush doesn't care about black people classic, now feels like an icon looming so large in our cultural zeitgeist, media outlets cannot resist taking Kanye at his word anyway, desperate to document anything that he might say. I might argue that this obsession with reporting on Kanye's idiocy is in some ways a quest to let a black man make an ass out of himself on a large stage, thus implicitly validating the idea of African Americans as smaller minded. I might argue that a lot. But as I expressed in 2018, and as I am definitely expressing now, I just really want to be done with Kanye. We really should be. He made some great music for a while, and then he started liking Jesus a lot. He shouldn't be in a position of power and influence, but unfortunately he is, and the very least we could do to help him out is not pay attention to him. We shouldn't take any of this or anything he does seriously, and we all know that. Kanye to me feels like that one family member you've decided to cut ties with because of how crazy they're being, but then everybody else in your family keeps telling you, oh, did you hear what happened with Kanye? And it's like, yes, I'm trying to eat dinner, Mom, so maybe let's talk about something else. Now, unfortunately, the other way this is fucked up, in opposition to what I just said, is how seriously we should take this. Now, do I think Kanye West could ever be president? No. Never, not in a million years, but that is what I said about Donald Trump in 2016, so I don't know. Let's think about it. Kanye West, as a political figure, is a black conservative. Even if he ran with his so-called birthday party supported by Elon Musk, his anti-vaccination, pro-life Christian platforms could garner serious support, especially among voters who felt disillusioned by the Democratic Party, but know that Republicans are much too racist to vote for. So even if we never got a Kanye presidency, this could siphon away a portion of votes from Joe Biden, who, let's be honest, none of us are really psyched about, which Kanye himself said he was okay with. And don't think that he couldn't do that, by the way. I mean, people believe that the Earth is flat and that 5G towers have created coronavirus, so people would support Kanye West becoming president. We used to sort of, as a country, just laugh when Kanye would do things and be, haha, Kanye, and then we moved into this eye roll Kanye, but things are really serious now. So now it feels more like, oh God, Kanye, please don't do that. Just go taste sounds with your synesthesia or whatever you do on a regular basis. Hang out with Jesus, pray, yell at the sky, play piano outside like you like to do, but just don't go into politics. I don't know. This is not funny because Kanye jokes are a little bit hack, but also because it's genuinely not funny to think about how much worse our country could get. I mean, don't get me wrong, it is a joke, the cosmic joke even, but it feels like the joke is on us and that God is punching down. When you look at where we're at and where we're all going, I wouldn't be surprised if we were about to be attacked by a Godzilla, or maybe several Godzillas. Godzilla, is that the plural? Oh well. So, without delving too deep into anything about this, I do want to make an incredibly obvious point, and it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway, in the way that Kanye himself would say it if he, you know, was more neurotypical and had it together. And that thing is, don't vote for Kanye. Don't vote for Kanye West. He wouldn't be a good president. Don't vote for Kanye. Don't vote for Kanye. 2020. But seriously, don't do it. All right, bye.
Skylar Higley is a Salt Lake City native who now lives in Chicago, writes for The Onion and Conan. And that's that. This has been the Machete Audio Magazine, July 11th, 2020. Thanks so much for listening. The Paper Machete is produced by Leah Munsey and myself, Christopher Pyatt, and our audio engineer is Jacob Serio. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode and want to give the Machete a financial boost while we keep enduring this shutdown, you can visit thepapermachete.org/support, or you could just rate and review us on iTunes, which would also be lovely. Our current, not to brag you guys, our current average rating on iTunes is 5 stars, and my mom and dad have no idea how to use iTunes, so they definitely did not do that. Anyway, we're going to leave y'all with one more from Sam Trump. Thanks for listening, and good night, Mrs. Steinberg, wherever you are.
One look in your eyes, it sets me straight for a day. And one touch satisfies, it simply makes me okay. And your smile is sunshine, it breaks clouds. This way, oh. I wasn't looking for love, but I found it. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't look for anything but love, and I found it. Yeah, I found you. Ooh. Your presence fills me up. Satisfaction in your touch. Oh, contentment in your love. So for this next verse, I compare my love to cake. Can everybody say cake? So let's see if you can catch these references. It's like, you're an angel, you're the epitome of great. And I just gotta say, you take the cake, sock it to me. You German chocolate, warm cinnamon coffee. You give me 7 up even in an off week. The mold of a bunt, cause you touch softly. You touch soft. Zest of a lemon, the flavors in your skin. And sexy red velvet lipstick on your grin. Expensive taste, you're made from 24 carats. And you're so sweet, say for me the big piece. Your curves and proportion matches. And your words hit my sense of smell. It serves me well, like I can tell there's 5 minutes left. Best warm, and that's normal, cause you've been warm forever. Warm since the day you were born, like right out the oven, since you were delivered. A cake to celebrate us, wedding with the layers. Cause we're constantly building. I wasn't looking for love, but I found it. Yeah, I mean, I would look for anything but love, yeah. But I found it. Yeah, I found you. Woo. Your presence fills me up. Da 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 da. Satisfaction in your touch. Contentment and your love.
Mr. Sam Trump and his band. They're here all afternoon.